As soon as that bell rings, I stand right up. I don't even think about it anymore. It's kind of like my body has been trained to respond in that way. But it's really because I've spent the last 6 years hearing that same exact bing in the same place for the same exact reason. A customer. I slowly poke my head around the corner of our pack room, which is less like a room and more like a thin floor-to-ceiling fancy plywood wall that just so happens to separate customer from service. It's beige, it's boring, but it is dressed with dozens of these small cutout faux wood squares to hang ads, which for us is usually just one. We can print that. Coming around the wall, I head to the counter, walking about 10 feet or so to greet the customer. But they were just dropping off some mail. Still, we exchange one of those wonderful but silent neighborhood waves, which for me has evolved into something that resembles being rejected for a high five. They leave, and I head back to the pack room to get back to my real work. Nothing. Well, not nothing exactly. We like to watch movie trailers, pound coffee, and talk about the news of the day. And trust me, I know it's my job to help people. I will. I do. But this happy nothing between customers is absolutely required in order to make it where I work. You see, at my job, customers will break you. Because really, at the end of the day, they just don't want you breaking their shit. That's because where I work, we pack and ship things. And not just any things either. Antiques, immigration paperwork, high-value electronics, and even a Picasso painting. Why some stranger would give me that responsibility, I have no clue, but you get the idea. On top of that, we also make copies, distribute mail, reteach basic computer skills to customers, and direct every delivery-related question to the worldwide $100 billion company our family-owned franchise shares a name with. And while I can't exactly say where I work, I can describe how it makes me feel. Because I have to hope that it's how a lot of other people feel. Because this is retail, and there are over 15 million of us ready to share our stories from behind the counter. We have a joke at work. It's more of a comparison. We'd like to call ourselves retail firefighters, with a huge emphasis on the retail part. But the comparison lies in our routine. It's a hurry-up-and-wait environment with some periods of calm to bookend the chaos. At our job, all it takes is one bad call or one bad shipment or one bad interaction with a customer, then chaos. At the core of this is this idea or operating philosophy at this point that the customer is always right, that before we even walk through the door of a retail establishment or any store in general, we're expecting something. We buy groceries at a grocery store, clothes at a clothing store, and hardware at a hardware store. But there's a catch. At the end of your shopping experience, and oftentimes throughout it, there is always some lowly employee acting as temporary gatekeeper between you and what you desire. The best part? You're right. And the gatekeeper? Well, they don't work for a company, they work for you. And if you don't care for them, all you gotta do is ask for their manager. But what if even they say no? What if they don't have what you need or some system of theirs is down? What then? Well, if you're like Michael Douglas in the 1993 film Falling Down, being told no when no is the answer may be a tough pill to swallow.
We stop serving breakfast at 11:30.
Rick, have you ever heard the expression, the customer is always right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, here I am, the customer.
That's not our policy. You have to order something from the lunch menu.
I don't want lunch. I want breakfast.
Yeah, well, hey, I'm really sorry.
Yeah, well, hey, I'm really sorry, too.
Spoiler alert. Michael Douglas doesn't get his breakfast, and then he holds the place up for a while to complain to patrons about the state of his burger. But that's in the movies. And while very hyperbolic, the scene does illustrate how quickly this mantra of being right can take a wrong turn if both parties can't commit. So how can we make sure this doesn't ever happen? We can't. And we might not want to. But if we are to rethink the phrase, it might help to know where it came from in the first place. Well over a century ago, two people are given credit for originating the phrase, though its true origins are linked to Cesar Ritz, the Swiss founder of the Ritz-Carlton hotel chain. And I'm not going to embarrass myself by saying it, but I will translate it. It says, "The customer is never wrong." Across the pond in the US, though, two other wildly successful businessmen, Harry Gordon Selfridge and Marshall Field, are credited with our current interpretation. And at least for them, it worked. Selfridge, who spent a large chunk of his career working for Field, later took his earnings to open up one of the biggest clothing retailers in the UK. And Marshall Field's legacy can be seen and felt all over the city of Chicago today. Both rich, both not typically accustomed to working on the sales floor. But for us, the workers, how has the evolution of the customer is always right affected our day-to-day? I met up with Mara for coffee on a Sunday afternoon. We talked outside, just like any two sensible Chicagoans would do in the middle of November. Mara started working in retail at age 16. She spent 4 years at PacSun before taking on a management role at The Gap, where she stayed for another 4 years.
I think at the time I was really interested in like the business aspects, especially in retail is selling. You take a lot of pride in what you can sell. So that is what I wanted to start pursuing in school. And then I quickly realized, oh, I actually like fashion. So how can I get closer to fashion? What's interesting to me? And for me, it was working in a clothing store. It's cool to get discounts. You kind of feel like you know a few extra things, especially working for like big companies like Gap. It's a huge company. They've been around forever. So it was cool to feel a part of something a little bit bigger, even though like in hindsight, it really wasn't that much bigger. But to like little old me at the time, it made me feel cool. And you also, working in places like those, you meet people that are like you or have similar interests, and met a lot of really great people.
Mara still works in the fashion retail industry, but she's no longer on the sales floor. She's in an office environment now, but she still maintains a close relationship with her company's customers.
You know, I don't talk to customers all day. I do a lot of administrative work, so I take escalations. So if someone says, I want to talk to your manager, they'll talk to me. And as a global company, or, you know, in this case, I take calls for all North America. There's a lot that we're responsible for. And they think because we're a really big company, they have really high expectations. So usually, you know, I'll of course do whatever I can to exceed those expectations, but it's frustrating to me when I can't, and further frustrated when people aren't understanding.
While Mara doesn't spend the entire day with customers anymore, when she does, it's usually to address some sort of technical difficulty. And if you handle escalation calls for a living, well, tempers can escalate as a result.
In my role now, I deal with our online segment. So a lot of what we deal with is being responsive when people have technical difficulties. Many of those things are very much beyond our control. Of course, I'm in communication with our IT department and we'll do what I can, but that being said, we're limited to our resources available. Really recently, actually, like last week, this guy was really upset that one of his items, he put in an order, and one of the items was sold out when we went to go ship his order, so it got canceled. He never got charged for it or anything, but he called and he was absolutely irate, and he just didn't understand the concept that there are limited quantities of things, and so just because you clicked that button doesn't mean you're going to get that item. You know, we only have so many. And he was just so insistent. And at a certain point, you want to say, well, it's not like I can go, like, sew you that jacket right now. You know, I can't sell it to you. I would much rather sell it to you than be having this, than have to give you bad news. But I can't sell it to you if we don't have it. So he was really upset, and he actually proceeded to write, like, a whole letter about me, and really, our whole department saw it. Of course, they knew I wasn't wrong, but he just didn't really seem to get the fact that, first of all, it wasn't about what I wanted to do or what I didn't want to do. It's what I was capable of and what our stock quantities were capable of fulfilling. So he was not right. Like, I could not do what he wanted me to do. People's money, they feel super entitled to it. Like, you have my money, I am your loyal customer, you need to do this for me. That's the general attitude. But in that case, like, we didn't have that man's money for that item, you know. But I think that it's all about their money, so they think that because we have that, or because that they're a patron of our business, that they have this sense of entitlement about what we should do to please them, when, you know, what's interesting to me is that there's not a filter on the type of person that can pick up the phone or walk into a store location. Anybody in any mental state, condition, background, whatever, can just, in most places, walk in or pick up the phone and call us. And we're expected to pander to anything that they say. They want us to support them, be kind to them, no matter what they say to us. And it's not, I don't think we have to do that. I don't think we should have to do that. But they certainly expect it. And it's like, not that, you know, of course we want to believe in the customers, but not every customer is right or well-intentioned. Us as equals at all. They see us as someone that's there for them, and in a large way we are there for them. We're also there for ourselves to make our own living. That's why many of us go to work, is to make money. Hopefully it's in a field that you care about, that you want to be doing or are good at doing in some capacity, but it's not an equal relationship.
However, on a personal level, Mara understands how easy it is to put the blinders on while you're a customer in pursuit of a sale.
I really try hard not to, but sometimes I do realize, like, all that stuff just flies out my head. And, like, I'll look at a sign that says up to 30% off, and I'll just see that 30% off. You know, people see what they want to see, and sometimes I fall victim to that too. But then I realize, like, you know, why are these things this way? Like, let's look deeper into it and maybe, like, not be that person. But if something's wrong, if I see, like, a thing that really needs changing, then maybe I will be my customer service self and address that needs changed. But usually I try and be a respectful human, especially considering most of the people you interact with. Like, I'm not talking to the business owner, I'm talking to someone that is there for 8 hours or maybe even 4 hours, you know?
I also had the pleasure to speak with Liz Woody, who, like Mara, has spent years working with, and sometimes for, customers. Their journey into the world of retail began at one of America's favorite shopping pastimes, a department store.
The very first job I had in retail, it was my very first job ever. So I was probably 14, turning 15 when I started it, and it was for our local Sears. And one of the main reasons that I applied to that Sears is because my boyfriend at the time worked there, and I was like, oh, this is a sweet gig, like, I'll get to see him all the time, it's gonna be great. And it was probably my worst retail experience out of all of them. You're always trying to push something, so, like, credit cards were, like, a really big thing, and that always made people mad. And so I didn't like to ask people if they wanted to apply for a credit card. Also because it felt like I was taking up so much of their time. And so that was a problem for me because my bosses were obviously trying to fill quotas, and that was rough.
While 15-year-old Liz did their best to sell customers a line of that sweet, sweet Sears credit, like many first jobs, it just wasn't meant to last. The next one, though, for Liz, was special.
So the second job, I worked for a small business, and it was called The Toy Store. And that was actually my favorite retail job that I've ever had. At Sears, mostly my customer interaction was, like, checking people out. I didn't really help them a whole lot as far as, like, finding what they needed or really anything other than just, like, ringing them up or dealing with returns. My customer interaction at the toy store was a whole lot different because we were encouraged to really work with the customers and to, like, have such a vast knowledge base of our products, so toys, to find what the perfect fit would be for them. And it was just great. It was a really, really wonderful experience. We were closing. We were getting close to closing one night. And this older gentleman walks in, and it was wintertime. This older gentleman walks in, and he says, "I'm looking for a very specific kind of sled." And I was like, "All right, like, can you describe it to me? Do you have maybe a brand name that you know?" And I don't think he had a brand name, but he definitely described it to me. And it was like, oh, it was a wooden sled. And I think it had, like, the curl in the front is the kind that he was looking for. And I was like, oh, we definitely don't sell those. Let me see if I can find a store that would have those for you. So I looked at, like, the other options we had in town, you know, like Walmart, Target, those sorts. I even looked at, like, Dick's to see if maybe for some reason they would have them. Right, exactly. So then I just did a Google search, and I was like, all right, where can you find these sleds? And it turned out the one that he was looking for was only from, like, a very specific supplier. So I wrote down, like, their website if he wanted it, and, like, a phone number for him to call, and business hours. And I gave it to him, and it's still one of my favorite memories because he was so pleased. He was so excited that he knew a place to get the sled, and I think it was probably for a grandchild, and that he was able to pass on this memory to his grandchild. Be like, this is something that I remember, something that's, like, important to me. I mean, I don't really think it's, like, a matter of the customer always being right, you know? I think it's more like this human being in front of you comes first. And it's not necessarily that, like, they're a customer and you're an employee, so you just have to do what they say. It's more that, like, this person has come to this specific location and to you as, you know, being the person that's there for help. And if you can help them, you help them. Like, that's just what you do. And so, like, I think the toy store definitely had the mentality that whoever walks through that door, it doesn't matter who it is or, you know, like, what's going on with them and their life. If they need help, you help.
So, is the customer always right? Is anybody? Mara and Liz both use an important word here: human. It's impossible to be right all the time or even expect to get your way. And it's just as difficult to go through life never having unintentionally taken your day out on someone else. So, for now, can we just settle on the customer always being human? Capable of mistakes, kindness, anger, and generosity, and sometimes some combination of all four. Anyway, thanks for listening to the pilot episode of Retail. I'm Dylan Van Sickle. We open back up in a few weeks. Retail is written and recorded by me and edited by Cody Corral. The illustrations you see on the page are provided by Jenny Holtz, and this episode is published by 14 East Magazine.